This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Since Thomas Edison recited the story about Mary and her little lamb, millions of Americans have recorded all kinds of sounds on all manner of devices, and most of them are lost, including Edison's original wax cylinder. More than a century later, many groups are trying to preserve our audio record, and yesterday the Library of Congress inaugurated a national recording registry that will permanently preserve the most important. The first 50 are an eclectic selection: spoken word, like poetry and speeches, natural sounds, birds and animals, mechanical sounds, and music.
Under the breadfruit, banyan, palm leaf, or under the bamboo tree, any old tree will do for me. Any old wood is just as good. Any old aisle is just my style. Any fresh egg, and sound of sorrow.
Edison's recording of the Pattison Waltz, T.S. Eliot, and Aretha Franklin, three of the first 50 items to be included in the National Recording Registry. By the way, if you'd like to look through the whole list of the first 50, it's on our website at www.npr.org. Later in this program, we'll bring you an update on the elections in Israel today. Polls there have just closed. NPR's Peter Kenyon will give us the latest. But first, Save Our Sounds. As part of the project, the Library of Congress aims to establish a national standard about how sound is maintained. We'll talk about that. We'll also hear from a few others involved in preservation projects, and we want to hear from you. What sound would you nominate for this prestigious list? If you have a nominee, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. One nomination per customer, please. But you can also call with questions about how and why and what to do if you want to listen to your Uncle Charlie's old dict belts. Again, the number is 800-989-8255 and the email address totn@npr.org. And to see the list, go online at npr.org. Samuel Berlosky is the director of Recorded Sound Section at the Library of Congress. He joins us here in Studio 3A, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
The National Registry, how'd you pick 50 out of all the millions of items that have ever been recorded that we still have?
Well, it was a long but fun process. The National Recording Preservation Act, which Congress established in 2000, created a board for the preservation law to advise a librarian of Congress. So the board, after much discussion, decided on 50. Congress didn't tell us how many to select. And then the board reviewed public nominations and made nominations of their own, and then they voted, but the final arbiter was the librarian of Congress. It was his selection of which 50 to include.
So somebody's got to be responsible, and he's it.
Well, that's what the law tells him to be, and he was.
All right. How did you go about soliciting public nominations?
We put out a press release and a website and asked for nominations. I don't think we got anywhere near as many as we would have liked, but now that the first registry is out and people react to it either positively or negatively, I'm sure we'll get more this year. I'm looking forward to it.
Sam is going to be taking notes as you call in with your suggestions. If you send us email, we'll forward those on to him, so they will all count as nominations, but I'm sure we'll just be a small part of all of this process. One of the difficulties involved in this is there are a lot of different duplicates of various kinds of recordings.
Well, that's correct, and I think in one reason that makes it good that the registry, which was just announced yesterday, includes common recordings as well as unpublished and unique recordings. So even a common recording might have three or four versions out released, and we'll make sure that we have the original, something closest to the original. I'm sure Aretha Franklin's Respect was recorded in stereo, but maybe not. But, you know, sometimes certain recordings got different mixes, or they went back into a studio to make a stereo version.
Yeah, in those days, often you got a mono recording on the 45. We still had 45s in those days, and a stereo mix later on the album version.
Yeah, exactly.
So, which one did you pick?
Well, we didn't make a designation of Aretha Franklin's. We have to go back and, I mean, we want her original, and we have to go back and see whether there is a stereo and mono version of that.
and as which one was mixed when, and then decide.
Yeah, it's late enough, being mid-60s, that there's probably one stereo version, so we'll pick the stereo if that came out originally. If it came out many years later, probably not.
Now, there is a restriction that something has to be at least 10 years old to be even considered for inclusion.
That's right. Congress put that in there, probably just to give taste a chance to settle, see which recordings have legs and which not.
And the other part was in this first list of 50, as you heard in those brief excerpts there, clearly the span of time was one of the factors of some very early stuff and some from quite recently.
Mm-hmm. I think the earliest is from 1888, that wax cylinder that you heard, Effie Stewart singing, which was from a recording that Edison used to go out and literally show off his improved phonograph in the late 1880s. He used it to go out to do demos. And the most recent one is The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five.
From 1980...
82, I think.
82. Mm-hmm. So from Edison to rap. So that's quite a span there.
That's our history.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's go first to Patrick, who's with us from Holly, Michigan.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Love the show. I've got a question concerning sound recordings from particularly the space age. In particular, I'm fascinated with this concept of the landing of Apollo 11. Of course, we're all familiar with One Small Step and so on, but I'm wondering, was there anything like a black box or any kind of a recording on the Apollo 11 spacecraft recording what the astronauts were saying that wasn't transmitted directly back to Earth?
I don't know. Sam, do you know?
No, I don't know. I would suspect so, and if it is, it would be in the National Archives and Records Service in College Park as part of their NASA collections.
I'm very curious because in some of the books I've read concerning the moon landing, I understand that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, after they landed on the moon, among other things that they said and did, of course, to shut everything down and so on, they actually shared a communion together. And I'm just curious whether, you know, there's any kind of a record of what they said and did in private that was recorded on the moon module.
Well, you may want to check out, again, those archives are where, Sam?
At the National Archives.
Okay.
All righty, I'll do that. Thank you.
Good luck, Patrick.
Thank you.
There are some other, you know, all of these sounds are somewhere archived. That's where you got them, right?
Yeah, we hope so. Well, certainly all the sounds on the registry. You couldn't be on the registry if it didn't exist.
Right. Yeah. Clearly. You know, mm-hmm. It's a tautology right there. But why pick out this particular, I mean, I know Congress mandated, but what's the theory behind picking out a special list of all the millions of recordings that the Library of Congress already has?
Well, I think there were two reasons for it. I think one was to assure the preservation of the recordings that were, as Congress put it, aesthetically, historically, or culturally significant, and build a body that will get first priority for preservation. And I think the other half is clearly a symbolic act to make people aware of preservation, bring this problem to people's attention.
A little like the American Film Institute nominating every once in a while three or four films to be permanently preserved in their collection.
Well, in part, actually, Congress established a series of laws to create a film registry at the Library of Congress. The first film registry was 1989, And this law was based on that successful program for film preservation at the Library of Congress.
And how are they going to be preserved?
Well, that's a good question because we're in the midst of a revolution in preservation. Years ago, we thought that perhaps the most permanent medium was an open reel tape. We now know there are problems with tapes, and in fact, you can hardly find a tape manufacturer anymore. There are only, I think, two in the world, or two major manufacturers of open reel tape. So what we're doing now is we're planning to preserve these as digital files, much like a file for word processing on your computer. And it would be a file of higher sound quality than that you would get on a CD, more things recorded, you know, denser, so to speak. And then as being maintained on files, we would migrate those files to different media as backup media for computers progresses over the next decades.
As we get bubble jet or whatever it is, the technology is going to be 20 years down the road.
Absolutely. For years, everybody was looking for the permanent medium. The nice thing about the digital files, which is they don't deteriorate, or you don't lose a generation when you copy them as you do tape, which is almost like carbon paper, if anyone remembers that, so that we are sort of liberated from coming up with a permanent medium. We just have to make sure that we maintain these files.
Our telephone number again is 800-989-8255. The email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And if you want to see the list of the first 50 pieces of sound to be inducted into the National Registry, you can look at it on our website, www.npr.org. And let's go now to Al, who's on the line with us from Plantation, Florida.
Hi.
Hi.
Are political addresses that may or may not have been put on records but were on TV eligible for this archive?
No, the criteria for being in the registry is that it has to have been released as a sound recording. I think there'll be a TV registry developed in the future. There's been a television preservation study, and Congress may ask us to create one. But right now, it's things that were released as sound recordings.
Okay, then I'd like to nominate Bill Haley's recording of Rock Around the Clock. That basically started rock and roll. And I think that was 1951, 52, around that time.
Oh, I think it's a little earlier than that.
No, I was in high school from 50 to 54.
Oh, I thought you said 60. I thought, never
mind.
No. I misheard you.
50 or 52, around that time, Rock Around the Clock. It was really the first recording that grabbed the kids, like myself at that time, and showed a different kind of music, a different way of approaching music, something a lot freer, a lot more spirited, a lot less traditional. And I really think personally that was the start of rock and roll.
Okay. Thanks very much, Al.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Now, that's one of their sort of a double entry. I mean, if somebody decided to preserve Blackboard Jungle,
right,
in which that song played a great part, would you count that as being on film and thus ineligible?
No, we count it because it was released as a sound recording.
All
and,
right,
of course, while Blackboard Jungle was a very popular film, more people heard this, I think, as a 45 and as a 78, as I recall. I mean, it sold lots of copies and continues to sell.
Let's go to some of the emails and check out some of the things that people are writing about. Nancy Merrill in Seattle votes for the sound of a handwritten personal letter being opened with a letter opener. That sound may not exist anywhere anymore. We have the sound of Sputnik beaming its signal back to Earth from Ross Harvey. Would that be something you'd consider?
Yes, I think so.
And Walter Barringer suggests from Fairfield, Connecticut, says we should save examples of Native American speech, a genuinely endangered culture. Again, if recordings were made, presumably they would be eligible.
Yeah, and in fact, there's Native American song on this first registry. Some of the oldest field recordings, I guess the oldest field recordings ever made from 1890 of Passamaquoddy Indians.
And from Stuart Nelson in Tallahassee, Florida, writes the line three times, "The Giants win the pennant, the Giants win the pennant, the Giants win the pennant."
Well, I think there's no question that there are going to be sports broadcasts on this registry. I myself would love to hear the ones that President Reagan broadcast. He would read the ticker taper and pretend he was at the game.
Recreations.
Recreation, but he did play-by-play live, but of course he wasn't at the game.
He used to tell a famous story about the wire broke down from Wrigley Field and had to fill for a good 20 minutes. One batter fouled off a whole bunch of pitches until the wire got repaired, and he grounded out to second base, as it turned out, on the second pitch delivered to him. We're talking about the Recording Registry, the Library of Congress's effort to preserve national heritage through sound. And we're taking your calls, 800-989-TALK, and email TOTN@NPR.org. What sound would you like to see included in the National Recording Registry? Coming up after a short break, Jay Allison, curator of NPR's Quest for Sound in the Lost and Found series, Lost and Found Sound series, joins us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the preservation of American culture through sound. Our guest is Samuel Brolowski. He's director of the Recorded Sound Section in the Library of Congress's Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division. NPR's Lost and Found Sound series ran for more than a year. It dug up some incredible sounds and reminiscences, and joining us now is Jay Allison, curator of the Quest for Sound for the series. Jay, good to have you on the show.
Hi, Neil.
Now, you might have heard some sounds from the National Recording Registry list yesterday. Did any of them surprise you?
Well, they were very different in nature from what we were doing with Lost and Found Sound.
Public recordings as opposed to the more
public
private
recordings.
Ones.
Yeah. We wanted to go into people's attics and into their storage boxes and find the things that they had saved, you know, that they had thought were treasures in some way, and pull them out and see where they intersected with our common life.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a different. Ours was a different enterprise from that. On that list, it was a lot of music, some sound, some voice, mostly music.
And as you were going through the sounds that people submitted to you, what was the biggest challenge?
Well, we aren't archivists or historians. We were storytellers. This is my partners, the Kitchen Sisters, mm-hmm. Who were the it was kind of their brainchild, this series. So we would look for sounds or voices or song that intersected with story, and that was people would call us up. I put out a call on NPR's air and said, what do you have? What's precious? What should people hear? And then we'd the people would call in, and you could tell in their voices the kind of connection they had to the sounds. You know, it's very emotional in a way, especially when your connection is to the sounds of people who've passed away or your mm-hmm. family members. And those would be the things they'd call us about, and you could tell in their voices that there were stories connected to the sound, and those are the things that we gravitated towards.
Mm-hmm. Were there sounds that intrigued you, but you end up not being able to use because of the poor quality?
More than that, it was sounds that intrigued us that just didn't read. You mentioned Sputnik before. We got an awful lot of calls of people who had sound. Sometimes people would have a sense that history was happening and they'd simply want to record it. They'd sit in front of their TVs and record it. Or we had one call that we always thought would make great radio, but it didn't. It was people sitting on a porch in Oklahoma. I think they were maybe playing music and watching Sputnik fly overhead and talk about it. And there was some odd romantic future past connection, and we got the tape and it was just indiscernible. There was the actual sound was not interesting, but the story of the sound was.
Sam, do these recordings that you would consider, would they have to have been copyright at some point? Does somebody have to own them? I mean, I think there are some great accidental sounds. I mean, the guy who was recording a dictabelt in the Empire State Building when a B-26 crashed into the building. And similarly, I guess there was a meeting being recorded across the street from the building where the Oklahoma bomb went off, the Oklahoma City bomb.
No, I think those would absolutely qualify, as well as much of what Jay and the Kitchen Sisters gathered. I know their intention wasn't preservation, but in a sense it was, in that so much of that was disseminated and is kept by NPR. It's fantastic stuff that is absolutely what should be on the registry, that type of thing, not just commercial published materials.
Jay, are you making sure that the stuff that you all gathered, that it's being preserved, other than through the stuff that we got here?
The sisters are working with the Smithsonian, and, it's all... also in digital format, available on NPR's website. If you go there to npr.org, you can get right to Lost and Found Sound, and every story we did, and sound, and background, and historical context is all on that Lost and Found Sound website. So that's another reasonable way, I think, to make archives lasting and accessible. I don't know if they're doing that down at the Library of Congress. Can you hear this stuff on the web?
Those which will be able to get rights to put on the web, we will. But an awful lot of them are copyrighted. It will be difficult.
How about pure sound? We got a lot of people calling saying, the sound of milk bottles clinking or my screen door slamming or a steam engine down the valley. That's what's gone. That's what I treasure and miss. We did a piece about the sounds of antique fans, which if you go to the website, you can see there are people who post the sounds of their old fans because that very hum, the distinctive nature of that hum is tied to their napping childhoods. Do you have that kind of sound that you're preserving, the ones that are kind of metaphorical?
We have a little bit what's published. We don't have much in the way of of that sort of random recording, it's perhaps something we should look into. I mean, I agree. Sound is so potent. It's like an aroma, more yeah. than a picture.
It's a direct connect. It's right. Gets right inside you.
Let's go to a caller, and Marilyn joins us now on the line from Seattle.
Hi. Well, my question was actually what you were just talking about in a way is when I listened, I thought what I would like to hear is what cities used to sound like say New York or another big city when there was no traffic noise, when the noise was street vendors and horses. I mean, I know that existed and it won't exist again, and I just wonder if there are sort of incidental recordings of that ambient, you know, noise before industrialization, before everything changed just so dramatically.
The sounds of silence.
In a way, except I think that those cities were noisy. I think they were crammed with people, and there must have been noise, but just such a different background noise than we have living in cities now.
Edison and the automobile were roughly contemporaries, but Sam, do you know if there are recordings of New York City,
Absolutely,
for example?
Absolutely, yeah. I agree with the caller. I don't think cities were ever quiet, and I think that the one that comes to mind was a fellow named Tony Schwartz, who did make a great effort to record sounds of New York City, and I think Folkways Records, which is now run by the Smithsonian, issues some of these that Tony Schwartz put out.
New York 16, New York, and of course everybody, I think, remembers his famous Daisy commercial, which is being revived in another context on television now. Here's an email suggestion from Tom Reinzel. I recommend that a vital sound to be recorded for our future posterity is the rather obnoxious beeping and scratching that has become so familiar and soon to be lost from the infamous dial-up connection. It has the sonic quality of a poor wire recorder from the 1920s, yet it comes from my 2000-plus vintage computer. This sound will most likely not be available in the next 5 to 10 years. I can't be the first to suggest this. I simply hope it's been done with the onerous lack of fidelity that it actually has.
Certainly, there's certainly a lot of callers and writers talking about the sounds of obsolescence, the sounds that we hated but we'll miss when they go.
We'll have to have them when they're still there. Marilyn, thanks very much. Good suggestion. Appreciate it. Let's go to Mark, who's with us from Manhattan in New York.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. What I think would be great to save permanently would be samples of how people make conversation, how they talk naturally, whether it's something like the Loud Family, the series that was Follow the Loud Family, and just when there's no real topic of conversation or even job interviews, when people are trying to make conversation, what their accents are, what their vocabulary is, just all that stuff that gets lost. You know, if you think of something like Huckleberry Finn, I would love to have a recording of how people sounded before there were recordings.
Jay, is that something that you found a lot of?
Well, you know, not as much really old stuff, because recording was a big production back then. I mean, you had first of all, you had to plug things in. Tony Schwartz, who Sam mentioned, was one of the first who kind of jury-rigged a portable recorder and would go out in the streets with it, and he got a lot of natural sound and people talking as they actually talk in the world. And much more now you can get that, the kind of verite sound. I think we won't have a lot of problem retrieving evidence of our existence. It's a little trickier around the turn of the century.
I'm a 57-year-old woman living in Beaverton, Oregon, writes Charlotte, unpronounceable, her last name, please excuse me. Because I cherish the memory of my New England grandmother's Yankee accent, I think that regional accents, which are dying across the country, should be preserved. Years ago, if you had a good ear, you could tell a South Carolinian accent from a Mississippi accent, an Iowan accent from a Minnesotan accent, and I fear these differences in their richnesses are disappearing. And similarly, of course, you could tell Brooklyn from the Bronx, and indeed, in some cases, which neighborhood in Brooklyn. So, anyway, Mark, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's go on now to Charlie, who's with us from Muncie, Indiana.
Yeah, I actually had a question and a suggestion for something to be saved. My question was about, I collect old recordings myself. I collect both Edison's and 78's and modern LPs. And I also record them and make digital copies of them to listen to. And the source material is often lacking. There's a lot of surface noise. There's a lot of crackly records that might have been played thousands of times. And I'm wondering, the sources, I'm assuming you want to start with the cleanest source, but a lot of that has noise to begin with. Are these recordings being remastered or changed for their archiving?
Sam?
Well, there's a theory of preservation is to get as close to the original as you can without restoring them. So the first thing we would do to be to preserve the best copy of the original we could get. Now, that doesn't mean we want scratches, so, but it might mean just thoroughly cleaning the record, finding the right stylus to play in the groove, or going back to the master tape, recording that with the best machinery, the machinery that's most like that which it was originally recorded, and then later for publication, you might actually restore it. So in many cases, preservation programs involve what they call a flat copy, with no changes made to it, and then a restored copy.
Jay, I wondered, when you were involved in Lost and Found Sound, obviously you're caring about broadcast. You're going to clean that up as best you can, right?
Yeah, we have different concerns. I mean, we go for legibility and try to make it as clean as possible because it's not a question of archiving what was original. It's a question of getting it so it sounds good over the air. And as you know, there are all sorts of remarkable digital tools now in digital audio workstations which remove hums and scratches and hiss. And so restoration has come a long way in recent years.
I know when I make CDs of my recordings, I always make two CDs. I make a raw, this is what it sounded like coming straight off the Edison player, and then I totally remaster and clean up and even re-EQ them and make a second version that's a stepped-up version.
Do you find yourself in some technological time warp when you're doing that, Charlie?
It's fantastic. I love it. I love a microphone stuck into the horn of the Edison player running into my computer and then doing digital remastering of it. It's sort of ties up, you know, 100-some years worth of technology in my living room.
You also had a suggestion, though.
My suggestion for recordings was the Jellero Morton's 1923 piano solos recorded at Jeanette Studios, like some of the first straight jazz piano solos that are just fantastic. It's that time warp thing of ragtime meeting modern jazz.
Well, they do have a couple of important jazz recordings, including Louis Armstrong's West End Blues. So let's listen to a little bit of Louis Armstrong. This is from the 1920s. Ah, that beautiful opening to the great West End Blues. This an important are recordings important, Sam, because they were popular or because culturally, historically significant?
Oh, of course it's both. I mean, something like Armstrong probably, I mean, I can imagine what it was like to be another trumpet player at that time in the mid to late 20s and have to hear Louis Armstrong and just, you know, I'd bang the palm of my hand against my forehead. And that was the way, of course, that most jazz musicians learn jazz. If they didn't go to a live performance, they'd heard recordings like this that they learned to play along with and then took the independent steps. So, yes, they're aesthetically important. Yes, they're culturally important in many ways, some more than others, of course.
Well, Charlie, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. I think Charlie's left us. And Jay Allison, very good to talk to you, as always. Appreciate you taking the time.
Nice talking to you, Neil.
Jay Allison speaking with us from Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. Now let's get back to the phones and go to Bernice, who's on the line with us from Westlake, Ohio.
Yes, I don't know if my nomination is appropriate for this, because it's not as old, and it's a voice that's probably on a lot of CDs. But I'm thinking of Judy Garland when she sings Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Over the Rainbow. Well, that was originally from the movie The Wizard of Oz.
Yes, it was.
So, Sam, that would be caught in the originally released on film part?
But we don't exclude anything like that if it came out as a recording.
And it certainly did.
And then, of course, then you get back to which one. I remember, I think there were some people discussed Judy Garland's Carnegie Hall performance, which includes
1964,
and that includes Over the Rainbow. I'm sure that'll be on there eventually. This to pick 50 sounds like a lot, but as you start to go through it, for every one you put on, you had to take something off, and I'm sure Judy Garland will be there eventually.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Do you know the Carnegie Hall recording, Bernice?
Yes, I think I have that CD. There's the CD was done from that.
Mm-hmm. That's a three-hanky job, that one.
Yeah, she had such a unique quality in her voice and an emotional quality that you won't hear again, I don't think. Her vocal instrument was so wonderful.
Well, thanks very much for the call and for the suggestion.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Have a good one. Let's go now to Jerry, who's on the line with us from Detroit.
Hello.
Hi.
My suggestion was that perhaps to preserve American culture, we should be recording everyday sounds that are happening right now. I know that they're not as old, you know, or historically interesting, but could serve a purpose in the future. When we're logging and archiving these sounds from the 20s, we have no idea what the person on the street sounded like, what it really, you know, was like to be alive back then. Now, if we begin to make an archive of today at today, I feel that perhaps it could be richer. We could leave, you know, a better something for future generations to look back on of a better, higher quality than what we have to look back on previous generations.
So are you suggesting that they go out and try to record stuff now that should be preserved?
Exactly. To start, instead of waiting for stuff that's published and then waiting for it to be 10 years old, perhaps we should be looking to see, you know, what's relevant now and record it.
Well,
record it rather than look back.
It may be a great idea, but I think the Library of Congress is generally reluctant to overlook what Congress wrote in the law.
Right.
And if they said 10 years, but Sam?
Well, I think folklorists and other people who do field work do record things. One of your callers mentioned dialect recordings. The library has a fabulous dialect collection. And I don't know whether folklorists are recording everyday sounds on the streets, but I think there's a good point to it. The purpose of the law wasn't to commission things, but there is certainly indication in this radio program that people are interested in preserving some of these everyday sounds.
Thanks very much, Jerry.
Thank you.
We're talking about the preservation of sound and what should the sounds be that are recorded and preserved permanently in the Library of Congress. And what are you saving in your sound file? When we get back from a short break, how the Museum of Television and Radio is maintaining its sound quality. And you can give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address, TOTN@NPR.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about the preservation of the national sound culture and history. Our guest is Samuel Brilowski, director of the Recorded Sound Section at the Library of Congress. To get in on the conversation, give us a phone call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Call us if you have a suggestion for something that you think, a piece of sound that you think ought to be permanently preserved by the Library of Congress in conjunction with the program Save Our Sounds. And also you can take a look at the first 50 items on our website at NPR.org. Now, remember how the Walkman quickly morphed into the Discman? The pace of sound technology has been incredibly rapid. As equipment gets smaller, storage space gets larger. How do preservationists keep up, and where do you go to find equipment to listen to that recording that you just dug out of your attic? Well, joining us now is Steve Smolian, a recording engineer and a specialist on the preservation of sound in obsolete sound recordings. Steve Smolian, good to talk to you.
Good afternoon.
Can you give us a quick rundown of some of the most prominent recording equipment that you have in your studio, or maybe some of the most unusual?
Well, the most frequently used that seems to be out of use now is the LP turntable in many cases. But certainly before that is the 78 player, wire recording, dictation belts, the little audio tapes that we used during the Vietnam War as people sent messages back and forth to their families, a very wide variety of cardboard records that we used during World War II. I can go on and on about this.
yes, I suspect you can. But basically, one of the things you do is help people to find ways to listen to odd pieces of sound.
Well, I do preservation work here in the studio, and I do have a website where there are pictures of all these old obsolete formats so that people can find what it is they're holding in their hand.
And if people wanted to go look at that website, where would they go?
soundsaver.com.
Okay. Now, you've seen an awful lot of changes in the process from analog to digital. Mini discs have replaced, to a large degree, the audio cassette. Are you always in the business of playing catch up?
The rest of the world is just moving ahead of me.
I guess that's another way to look at it.
The catch-up is more in finding other old obsolete audio format playback machines and finding some way to get them so they play back the formats properly.
What's been the most difficult for you to find?
There's no one difficult. Some of them are pretty complex to get them to work right. Wire recording seems an easy enough technology until you get involved with the snarls that badly wound wires cause, which are almost unsolvable. It's like playing pickup sticks with a thin wire.
Well, everything is now being preserved either on a CD or DVD. That's the present. Do you have any thoughts on what the future looks like? Is it going to be as the Library of Congress is doing on computer?
That's, of course, a wonderful technology, and for right now, those who can afford it, it's probably the best idea. There's a history of the technology catching up as the prices drop. Things that seem impossible now become commonplace 5-10 years from now. Right now, we're using compact discs because there's a set of standards for them. That's not true of the DVD. And I'm not sure that you want a DVD, the future one, the one with the blue laser that will hold yet a great deal more sound if you only have 15 minutes to preserve.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. Our next caller is Heather, who's on the line with us from Livermore, California.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
My question is, I have a cassette recording that my mom made in the 70s of my great-grandmother talking about coming to Missouri in a covered wagon, and I'm trying to figure out what I can do to preserve that. I don't even have a tape player anymore, so I don't know what to do with it.
Steve Smullyan, any advice?
It's useful to know what the original machine was that was on which the tape was made, simply because there were also all kinds of noise reduction systems that went along with that. If you can identify whether it was a Dolby or not, a Dolby B, Dolby C, or none, then my suggestion is to go on eBay and find a machine and make a copy through your office computer or something like that. You don't need me to do it.
Okay. So you could just use if you find one of the old existing machines. I couldn't use any cassette tape player?
You can use any cassette tape player. I'm assuming that you're going to need that Dolby switch, and I don't see them on the newer players very much.
And Heather, just as somebody who has operated an awful lot of cassette machines in my lifetime in the business that I'm in, it is always vastly superior to play it back on the same machine it was recorded on, if at all possible.
Well, I seem to remember it being this little handheld job that, you know, I had at the age of 6. So,
it may not have survived.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
The other thing is to be sure that you clean the machine properly before you put the tape on.
Okay.
That's one of the great bugaboos of taking a rental car that has a cassette recorder and find out that the rental car company has never cleaned out the cassette player and your tape gets jammed in there.
And how do you connect, you know, one of these old tape players to your computer? I mean, obviously they weren't.
There's a method through the sound card.
Or there's
it should be in the instructions.
Or one of the oldest jokes in radio, with great difficulty.
Yeah, right.
Heather, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you.
Thanks.
Steve Smullyan, I appreciate your time as well.
Well, thank you very much, Neil.
Steve Smullyan is a recording engineer, a specialist on the preservation of sound in obsolete recordings. We spoke to him on the line from his home in Fredericks, Maryland. Let's go back and see if we get some more suggestions. And on the line with us now is Greg in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Hey, Neil. How are you doing this afternoon?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, listen, Steve already mentioned it, but there is a treasure of history that nobody, I don't think, has tapped. There's probably tens of thousands of these 3-inch reel-to-reel 15-minute tapes that were used during Vietnam. I have about 100 of them that I'm doing of my own from my family. But servicemen and their families corresponded back and forth. And when you listen to something that was recorded when you were a 20-year-old in 1968, I think that we have some living history that nobody's really tapped.
Sam, is that something that you would consider?
Absolutely. And the library is actually also administering the Veterans Oral History Project. And perhaps if we spell oral as A-U-R-A-L or something, it is oral history. Indeed, it's more not so much memories, but as it happened. And I think that's something they'd be interested in.
If Greg or somebody wanted to get in touch with you and actually say, I've got these particular recordings, do you want them, how might they do that?
They should email the Recorded Sound Reference Center at rsrc@loc.gov. And we have built these collections through the generosity of donors. We're always interested in things. If we say no, it's usually because we have them, not because we don't think they're good enough for us. We want to document American sound.
If you could put that on the website, so I'm in my car right now, I can't write it down. But one last comment before I go. I'm absolutely amazed that even though these were recorded with a very inexpensive little 3-inch portable reel-to-reel, and the way that that was done is people would do 5 and 10 minutes at a time and leave it alone for a week and come back. So when you'd get a tape, you'd have a chunk of 3 to 7 days of history from one end of the world to the other. But I'm surprised the ones that I have played back recently that 35 years later, these very inexpensive garden variety reel-to-reel tapes are still very usable, and although I'm going to archive them digitally, people that have ones like this shouldn't be discouraged about ever trying to listen to them again because they've heard that old tapes print through. They don't necessarily have to be bad.
Okay, Greg, thanks very much for the suggestion.
Thank you.
And by the way, we will put that that email address on our website, so if you or anybody else wants to check it out, go to npr.org, okay?
I'll do that. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Let's see if we could get one last suggestion from Don in Bear Valley, Alaska.
Hi, Neil. It's a real honor to be on your show.
Oh, well, thanks very much.
I'd like to nominate Gil Scott Heron's album, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, not only for its power to echo the voices of Afro-Americans in that time, but I found that as a poet, his ability to span both gender and race echoes even now, especially given some of the sentiments that we are facing from both the right and the left these days.
Wasn't that the Lost Poets?
He was a part of the Lost Poets. However, I feel that in some ways he really stood aside from them. If I could very briefly quote of himself.
Extremely briefly, please.
He said, I was introduced into what is laughingly referred to as civilization. This term itself demonstrates how mankind has managed to maintain a sense of humor throughout all of history's chaos.
Well, Don, thanks very much, and good luck.
Thank you.
One final email suggestion from Ruth Foley in Palo Alto, California. She would like to nominate Mayor LaGuardia reading some of the Sunday comics to the children during the New York City newspaper strike in 1930. Question mark, she puts, but it was a 19... Actually, I thought it was 1940, but anyway, could have been. Way back when, in any case. We'd like to thank our guest who's been with us here in Studio 3A. Samuel Brilowski is director of the Recorded Sound Section at the Library of Congress. He's been taking notes. You can hear his pencil squirming across the page even as we speak, and we're going to forward all of your emails to him at the Library of Congress. Thanks very much for coming in, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
And good luck with the project.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.